When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Tell Me About Your Mother. I am thrilled to feature another Amy today, journalist and podcaster Amy Roost. You may have heard some of Amy's story on her Finding Rebecca episode of Snap Judgment, or read about it in the complimentary story that ran in the New York Times. She also hosts a podcast on my network, Critical Frequency. That podcast is called Fury, and it explores how women are living with and using their anger in Trump's America. It's really great and you should check it out. Amy has also been editing a related anthology of essays, also titled Fury, and she recently wrote an incredible story for Dame magazine about her experience dealing with two children with brain disabilities and then tracing the root of those health issues to a commonly used household chemical. There was a related Snap Judgment episode on that one too, about having to make a decision for her son when he was unconscious and worrying that it might be a decision he disagreed with. Anyway, Amy's had an incredible life, and we get into a lot of it in this interview, including some potentially sensitive issues, so just a warning up top in case you're listening with kids.
Tell your children not to hold my hand. Tell your children not to understand.
This episode of Tell Me About Your Mother is sponsored in part by Zola, the wedding company that will do anything for love. Zola is reinventing the wedding planning and registry experience to make the happiest moment in couples' lives even happier. You start with your free wedding website that's super easy to set up. You can choose from 100 beautiful wedding website designs that fit any style or type of wedding. And then you can put your Zola registry on the website so that guests can get all the details in one place and buy your gift there too. It's great. The registry part is super easy too. The Zola store has the widest selection of gifts at all different price points. There's free shipping and returns, price matching, and you can choose from over 500 brands, including OXO, Cuisinart, Sonos, and Airbnb. You can also create funds for your honeymoon, future home, a new puppy, anything you want. Plus, you can register for gift cards to your favorite brands like Delta, Southwest, Hulu, Home Depot, and more. They also offer this awesome 20% completion discount, so any of the remaining gifts on your registry you can purchase for 20% off after the wedding. To start your free wedding website and also get $50 off your registry on Zola, go to zola.com/tellme. That's zola.com/tellme. Okay, back to the show. I want to know if you have any sort of early memory of your mom that's connected to how you think of her as a person. So it doesn't necessarily have to be like your earliest memory, but the first time that you were like, oh, that's who my mom is.
There's a picture I have of her in my head where she's wearing white hot pants and this polyester shirt with big lapels with a graphic sort of bright color print on it. Mm-hmm. And she has her hair done because she would go into the beauty parlor and have it, you know, set. Yeah. And she had she always had great glasses. And for a while she did the cat eye thing. And mm-hmm. But in this image that I remember of her, she had these big sunglasses she yeah. was wearing. And then she had these Nancy Sinatra boots that she just rocked. And she had a nickname. We called her Thoroughly Modern Maggie. And so, yeah, I think that was probably early 70s. So maybe I was like 10 or something like mm-hmm. that. But that stands out for me.
That's so funny. Yeah. Okay. And then what was like, was she, I know, what age were you when your parents got divorced?
So my dad left when I was 6.
Okay. And you guys moved to San Diego.
We moved to San Diego after the divorce was final, so I wasn't It was a couple years. I was 8 when we moved to San Diego.
Okay. And then what was the situation with your mom financially? Like, was that rough for her in terms of like how she was going to support you guys and stuff like that?
Yeah. So she was, you know, my dad was very wealthy. My parents, the family was wealthy.
Yeah.
And my dad had started his own business that my mom helped him start. And so that was a bone of contention in the divorce, because my mom felt that she should have, you know, a portion of the business as well as the equity in their home. And she was fighting for child support and alimony, and their numbers were very far apart at the beginning. So it took a while. But when we moved to San Diego, I think she thought she wouldn't have to work. And I've seen some letters that were written back and forth between them where she says, you know, you said I would never have to worry about money. And, you know, you said I would, my standard of living wouldn't change. But that turned out to be not the case. And so I remember going with her in San Diego to a bunch of banks. And she just said, get in the car. We got it. We have to go to the bank. And mm-hmm. so we went to the bank, the first bank. And I stayed in the car, and she came out, and I could see she was about to cry, but she was just kind of like holding it together for me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what was going on, but I knew she was upset, and I was kind of, you know, trying to be a good girl,
yeah.
not make her more upset. Yeah. And then we, you know, she drove up this Rosecrans Street in San Diego, and she drove up the street a little ways, and she pulled into another bank. Mm. And so then she said, I want you to come inside with me this time. So we go into the bank, and mm-hmm. she's asked to see a banker, and I'm holding her hand, and she's actually holding my hand. I remember her like taking my hand. Mm-hmm. And we sit down at this banker's desk, and she says, you know, I'm recently divorced, and I just moved to San Diego, and I'm trying to open a line of credit. Mm-hmm. And you know, he asks, well, you know, do you have a job? No, I don't have a job, but I have alimony, and I'm receiving child support. And it was just, sorry, no, you know, I think he asked what about credit history. And so we get, you know, like, she's like visibly now, you know, about to lose it. And so she takes my hand, and she's like, okay, well, thank you very much. And she just like walks out of there really fast. I think like hoping she can get out the door before she starts crying. And we mm-hmm. get in the car, and then she's just crying.
Yeah.
And so then we go further down this Rosecrans, and we pull into another bank parking lot. And she says, okay, you're coming inside with me again. And we go in. And this time she gives them sort of the sob story, you know, like, my, you know, son is sick, and, you know, I have 3 children, and I'm responsible for all of them, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm, you know, single, and I, you know, I have, you know, all these credit cards, but they were all in my husband's name. And I remember this man very well, because he was, the only thing I remember about him is he had really yellow teeth, but I just remember the yellow teeth, and he was bald, and I remember those two things, and I just remember but staring at his yellow teeth, and he was listening and nodding his head, and then he's like, well, I'm going to give you a bank card with $1,000 on it. And that was what they called a credit card, like a bank credit card in those days was a bank card. Mm-hmm. And so then my mom did start crying. She started just, she lost it. And because she was just so grateful to this banker, and $1,000. I mean, I guess in 1972 dollars, it was more than, you know, obviously, yeah. But yeah. Anyway, that was a Bank of America. And I Ooh. Still to this day bank with Bank of America, even though they piss me off, because I just feel a sense of loyalty to them, because they were the only bank that would give my mom credit after her divorce in 72.
Yeah. Which was like an early time for women to even have any credit, right? Like,
right. Yeah.
Okay. And then what type of mom was your mom? Like, was she the like baking cookies mom, or was she?
Yeah. I mean, so it's, I think about this a lot, because she was a mom that she thought that parenting was about how much you loved your child. Mm. And so she loved us a lot, and we were all three of us adopted. Mm-hmm. And so she, you know, she used to tell us, you're loved twice as much. You are loved enough by your biological or natural parents to, for them to realize they didn't have, they couldn't give you the home that, you know, mm-hmm. you needed. And, mm-hmm. and then loved by us, you know, so much that, you know, we wanted to raise you.
Yeah.
But, because we were wealthy, she had, we always had, like live-in help.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we didn't call it a nanny. But anyway, we always had somebody around that was kind of looking after our, you know, our day-to-day needs, like meals and, you know, just sort of the gritty part of parenting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think my mom got to, you know, she got to be our parent when things were nice and when we were going places. And, you know, she didn't, you know, I don't think she had to roll up her sleeves and parent all that much.
Yeah.
Until after the divorce. So, mm-hmm. But she loved
that
us.
That must have been like a huge adjustment. Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. I think she really actually resented it, having to cope with all. And then, you know, my brothers were teenagers and getting in trouble. And but no, it was, she was just, she loved us so much. And that was evident to everyone. I don't know if I had ever known anybody that, you know, was so proud of her kids and so, you know, just demonstrative toward her children.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think she actually loved the day-to-day real work of parenting. I don't think that's when she thought of like, I want kids. I don't think she thought, oh, it's going to be hard and I'm not going to sleep very much. She had all that covered by other people.
Right. That's interesting. How old were you when you found out that you were adopted? Did they like sit you down and have a talk about it? Or like, how did that happen?
You know, I don't even know. It was that seamless. I imagine I'm, you know, maybe 3 or 4, but I don't remember an actual sit down.
Yeah.
I was just always understood that I was adopted. And of course, you know, my brothers, they were 6 and 9 years older than me and they were adopted.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this wasn't my parents' first rodeo, but
yeah,
I was just, understood that.
Yeah.
I was special.
And did you ever have a, like, I'm going to go find my birth parents moment?
Not until I was an adult and I was having trouble. I had some problematic pregnancies and I wanted to learn my medical history, but I really was not curious at all. I mean, I was really, you know, pretty satisfied for sure with my mom.
Yeah.
I had some problems with my dad, but I just felt like this was my organic family. I didn't yearn for like, you know, who was that person that brought me into the world.
Yeah. Okay. And then I want to have you kind of, I mean, I know it's a long and complicated story, but like a little bit summarize the Finding Rebecca story. Yeah. Cause it's such a wild story.
It is. Yeah. It's a Mr. Toad's wild ride story.
Yeah.
So my parents had adopted 2 boys mm-hmm. and they did get pregnant once, but my mom had a tubular pregnancy and I think they kind of botched the surgery. And so they wanted a girl
mm-hmm.
and they were going to adopt a girl that my brother, who's just younger than me, 6 years younger, but a friend of my aunt, my mother's sister, got pregnant and she asked if my parents would adopt her child and they did. And mm-hmm. it turned out he was a boy. So that was Bobby.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so they wanted a girl and they hired an attorney to interview a mom who was expecting. And the mom was white. And I don't even know, we don't know if they asked if the father was white, because I think they just maybe assumed that the father would be white since they were looking to adopt a white child, or if they asked, maybe she didn't tell the truth.
Yeah.
But they brought the child to the house, which we just discovered why that is, but that's another story for another day.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought the child to the house and my parents noticed that she was kind of blotchy and they asked if the nurse was with an attorney that brought the child, and they said, well, you know, she's just, you know, she's blotchy from the birth canal, you know, just kind of ruddy was the word I remember my mother using. And they said, mm-hmm. you know, it'll lighten up over a course of some couple weeks. So
mm-hmm.
then it didn't lighten up. She continued to get darker as her color came in.
Yeah.
And so my mom and dad suspected that she might be Black or at least biracial. And so they took her to the pediatrician who confirmed that. And by this time, they'd had her for about 3 months. Her name was Rebecca. And they'd had her for about 3 months. The amount of time varies depending on who you ask. But so my dad says she never spent the night in the house. And
Oh my God.
my brother, my oldest brother, who was 8 at the time, was like, no, she was there like about 5 months. It was cold when we got her, and it was really hot when, So anyway, my dad insisted that they couldn't raise her. And this was 1962. So in 1961, in the same town that they lived in, a minister had announced that he was going to adopt a Black child, and they had the home. The parents had threats on their home. The children had, threats against them. So we lived in an all-white community north of Chicago. That was, it was just, a different time, and they'd gone through this horrible integration crisis where they tried to build integrated housing, and the city condemned the development and turned the development into parks, which is are the parks where I ended up growing up, learning to swim and playing and that kind of thing. So it already had all this racial tension. And my dad, I think in part because he was, a businessman, and he didn't want it to affect his business status and status in the community, said no, absolutely not. And my mother by this time was bonded with Rebecca, and she didn't care. And my mother also happened to be a civil rights activist, and she was on the very small minority of residents in the community who a couple of years earlier had protested in favor of integrating the community, and met Eleanor Roosevelt as a result of that, because Eleanor Roosevelt was bankrolling this development. In 1959, she was protesting for the integration of Deerfield, which was 100% white, and this development was going in, and Eleanor Roosevelt, who believed that segregation was the scourge of society, and if we could just, integrate communities, that would solve racism, was bankrolling this development. And when the city planners and mayor found out about it, they wanted to condemn it, and they eventually did. But my mom was on the picket line, and people from CORE, University of Chicago, in fact, Bernie Sanders, there's pictures of him in Deerfield protesting, and the Black Panthers were protesting, and it was a big deal. It went on for like years. The court case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it was denied cert, and they upheld the city condemning the land. But anyway, that was in 59, and then she had Rebecca. She got, they adopted Rebecca, and that was in 62. And then in 65, she decided she wanted to go to Selma to march during the second march. And my dad was didn't want her to go. He just felt it would be dangerous. And I was, what, 3 at the time, and my brothers would have been like, 9 and 12. So my dad just was like, he supported the civil rights movement, but he just thought it was just a bad idea. And she this time stood up to him and said, I'm going anyway. And so she took a bus down there, and she slept in a Greyhound bus station, and then marched 12 miles a day for 5 days and stayed out in these camps on the side of the road. And so that, for me, those knowing that story, knowing what my mother, and those were the values she, passed to us. I mean, that's another thing I guess I would say. I was, how did I emulate her? I'm all about social justice, and I get that from my mom. And I've always wanted to make my mark, like do something that really made a difference, or be part of something, not do something, but be part of a movement that was really. And I was really busy raising sick children, so I didn't have an opportunity to do that. But then, I feel anyway, so that she just had really big shoes to fill. So she, in a way, as much as she was sort of in the shadow of the men in her life, she was also just this incredibly resilient 17-year survivor of cancer, single mom of 3 children, and my two brothers were just total hellions, doesn't even begin to cover it. And working mom, just sort of the Mary Tyler Moore type, where she was, so yeah, those are always those things about her have always just I've admired, and I've always felt inadequate because, especially because of the things like Selma and the Deerfield picketing and the things that she stood for and fought for, mm-hmm. and put her life at risk for. So it's like I'm still trying to live up to her legacy, and that's a good legacy to try and live up to.
Yeah. So then they took Rebecca back.
Yeah, so, okay, so
and then
they...
you were like the replacement.
I was the replacement child, I know, right. Which is so crazy to think.
Yeah.
Where would I have ended up if I hadn't been adopted by my family? And So they gave Rebecca back to social services, and mm-hmm. social services placed her with a family in South Chicago, mm-hmm. and she ended up having a great childhood. And then they adopted me like 6 weeks later. And what's really trippy about that I only just realized is that I came into a grieving home.
Wow.
And I experienced a home that I wouldn't have experienced if my parents hadn't already had this, child that they had adopted. And so my mom was despondent and still, I mean, she never got over it her whole life. Mm-hmm. She was bitter and resentful toward my dad because of this. And I think it's really kind of the original sin of our family. It was mm-hmm. really what broke my parents' marriage apart. So yeah, I came into this home that had just 6 weeks or so earlier lost a child.
Wow.
Yeah. And I don't know how my mom did it. I don't know how she managed to find love in her heart for me, but she did. Mm-hmm. And then, to just bring the story full circle, 53 years later, I decided to go in search of Rebecca. And this was after nobody in my family had talked to it, except for my mother once told me the story of Rebecca when I was about 10.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So the story had been told, and it was understood that I was never to mention it again. Mm-hmm. And I never did. And my mother never mentioned it again. And she died when I was 30. So, mm-hmm. 35. So, then I just decided I wanted to find her, and I did. I mean, that's a long story, so I refer you
so
to
crazy. Yeah,
right, New York Times,
right?
Right.
Yeah. It's such a crazy story. Okay, and then can you remember a time when you, like the first time that you kind of understood that your mom was a person separate from sort of like her identity as your mom?
Yeah. So after my parents separated, my mom started dating, and she met this man named Roy, mm-hmm. who, truth be known, I had a big crush on him. So my mom became the competition, right? It's like, no, this is my boyfriend. So I was like, maybe this was before we moved to San Diego, so 7 or 8. Mm-hmm. And I mean, obviously I had sort of, gone through object permanence and knew that my mom was separate from me. But this was where I really thought, she has this other life, she has. And I also was jealous because of all the attention she was giving to him, and all, she started going out more often, and dressing up, and her social life became much, much more active, even from when my parents were dating.
Yeah,
I mean, when my parents were married. So, mm-hmm. that was when I was like, she has another life, and she's interested in the same man I am. So yeah.
Okay, are there any sort of lessons that you picked up from your mom about being a mom yourself? Let's start there. Yeah. Anything that like she did as a mom that you are either like, I definitely want to do that, or I definitely don't want to do that?
Yeah, so most fall into the category of I don't want to do that. But I would say a couple things that I did want to do is my mom was always very affectionate and very, as I said, demonstrative and mm-hmm. Touchy-feely. And I've always been that way. I don't know if it was nurture or nature. I'm half Italian, so it's probably a little bit of both. And she was also very liberal. And that got her in a lot of trouble. And, you know, given her set of children, it didn't work out so well. But I was always really, I taught, I, she was liberal. So she would talk to us about, because that can mean anything. I mean, she had pretty, you know, lax, you know, come home when it the street lights come on, and which would be like 9:30, 10 o'clock in the summer, you know. And you know, she we were on a very long leash as children. But also she talked to us about everything. Like if we had a question, she answered it honestly. And I remember that feeling a lot different from my friends' parents, that, you know, there were taboo topics that you just didn't talk about. And yeah, so I, you know, asked my mom about sex, and I asked my mom about drugs, and you know, whatever it whatever I wanted, you know, she would tell me, and we would talk about, you know, Watergate and the Vietnam War. And it wasn't, she didn't talk down to me. She talked to me as an equal. And I think that's why her keeping Rebecca as a secret was so mind-boggling to me, because she wore her heart on her sleeve, and you know, she wasn't afraid to address any topic. And so when I found out she had a secret from me, it was devastating, you know. And it was just a complete shock that she would have kept something so important, like there was this other child, from me.
Well, and yeah, something that did probably really impact your childhood, you know. That's that, yeah, that's
And I
interesting.
think it was probably because it was just so painful, she couldn't talk about it. And I know she talked about it a little bit more with my brother Steve, who's 9 years older, because he remembers her, so he wanted to talk about it.
Okay, what are the don'ts?
Well, you know, my mom was super smart, and she could have been, I could see her maybe having become a civil rights attorney. And she worked for the Chicago Mail. Okay, so back up. You're probably going to ask this question, but she was born on a farm in Iowa, actually in Brooklyn, Iowa, which was recently in the news because of Molly Tibbetts. Very small town in Iowa. And she, when she was 12, she went to work for the neighbors down the road, taking care of their children. And but she was a very, very much, she wanted off the farm. And so she told me she used to write the words of like Paris and London, and you know, she when she practiced her cursive, she would just write out the names of all the places she wanted to travel to. So as soon as she graduated from high school, she moved to Chicago, and this was right before the end of World War II. And she moved in with her sister and another woman. So the three of them moved into this apartment, and they all went out and bought a whole bunch of stuff on credit at a like a department store. Oh, Carson Perry Scott, that's what it was. And then they returned half of it for cash. Like in those days, you could buy on credit, and they returned, and that's what they lived off of. And then continued to pay the minimum payments on the credit card, which is kind of
So
a funny
funny.
story. But she worked went to work for the Mailers Union, and Chicago Mailers Union. And I've seen letters from friends of hers who worked with her at the time saying, "You ran that place," and how, you know, I think today she would have been chief of staff, but then she was maybe an executive secretary, probably, you know, just the boss's secretary. But you know, she's just a smart cookie. And she so then, you know, having not having but giving up her career in order to have children and sort of become a socialite, because my dad ended up doing very well. I think she had to, you know, just give up. Well, I think she gave up her dreams, her career dreams, to become a mom. And it didn't occur to her that she could maybe try to do both. And I don't think my dad would have been down with that. He wanted a very certain lifestyle. So long story short, I think that she saw me as you know, her I think she wanted me to complete her dream. And so she tried to live vicariously through me. And she put a ton of pressure on me. I mean, she used to call me, her nickname for me was Prez, because she thought I would be the first woman president. And my graduation cake from high school said, you know, congratulations, Prez, on it. And this was a serious dream of hers. This wasn't a joke. And so, you know, I remember I was planning on going to law school when I was in undergrad. That was my intent. And when I decided I didn't want to do that, she was devastated. I mean, I was like, I had told her, you know, I'd killed somebody. I mean, she was just, it rocked her world. She could not believe I was giving up that dream because it was her dream. So that's one thing for sure. You know, like, do not live vicariously through your children. Do not. It's hard sometimes. Like, this is going to sound like I'm doing that. One of my sons works for NASA, and sometimes I'm like, yeah, I got a son who works for NASA. You know, it's like, and it's like it's my accomplishment. You know, it's like, and I get all catch myself. I was like, no, this is his accomplishment. You know. But that's one big thing. And, you know, she was a martyr. And she just,
that game.
All right. It's like, I think we should be smoking a cigarette and drinking a bottle of whiskey right now. It was hard being somebody who disappointed her. You know, because I can't tell you how many diapers I've changed, and you're gonna, you know, go for your PhD in Russian studies. Are you kidding me? You know, like I had become some junkie living on the street, you know, like I was just a total failure because I wasn't going to law school despite getting into Columbia. You know, I was like, So the martyrdom, we used to, you know, the old expression, if you could bottle the guilt and sell it, you'd be a millionaire by now. And we joked with her about that all the time, but it weighed heavy on me. And so I made a conscious effort not to do particularly those two things, live vicariously and not put a lot of guilt on my children. Like, you know, I would express what I would want, and I still do.
Right.
But then if they say no, and I've learned that, you know, okay.
Yeah.
You know, and that disarms them too. When I say,
then they're like, oh, wait. I mean, I guess
exactly. a little Aikido, parenting Aikido, like, oh yeah, like faked you out.
Okay, so what about in terms of relationship stuff? Like, was there anything that you saw your mom doing either with your dad or like with other men that she dated?
Oh my God.
That like informed, you know, or that you think might have like influenced how you are in relationships?
Yeah. So, well, for one thing, my parents fought just most of my life because Rebecca,
six when you guys split up, or when they split
up, and their marriage started going rapidly downhill. Like, my brother will say, I never saw them fight before Rebecca, and after Rebecca, that's when the fighting began. So
I mean, if he was like insistent on it, and like she saw Rebecca as her child, that's pretty that'd be pretty hard to get over.
And she didn't. And so the fighting in front of the children, and then my mom also would, you know, badmouth my dad again and again. And that was something, you know, I'm sure I did some of it when I separated from my kid's dad. You know, you get what do they call it? The crazy years, those first couple of years after a separation or divorce. And, you know, I said, I'm sure I've said regrettable things about my ex-husband. I'm positive of that. But I was always very cognizant of it, you know, not wanting to poison my children's opinion of their dad. So there's that. And I think the emphasis on appearance also, my mom, I don't think I recognized it at the time, but, you know, she was painfully thin. And I think it was very important for her to, you know, maintain sort of a model, as the Twiggy here is, you know, sort of a model-like weight. And, you know, the amount of time that she spent applying makeup and getting her hair set and, you know, her wardrobe, you know, she had two huge closets, and it's still didn't hold all of her clothes. And so I guess, you know, in terms of her relationships, the, you know, I think she really led with appearance, and as a, and she was so bright, but she didn't put any, as much value on her intelligence. She didn't, she, I don't think she thought men would. So she went with the looks, especially I think my dad having, you know, left her for another woman, you know, that kind of messed with her head too. Yeah. But the thing I remember that has informed me the maybe the most, and I think my husband's pretty grateful for this, is so when she was dating Roy, he lived in LA and we lived in San Diego, and we went up there one weekend. He had a studio apartment with this bed was on kind of a raised platform, and there was a little balcony type thing across the side of the bed. And then I don't know, I think he must have, anyway, it was open to the living room, and I was sleeping on the floor in the living room or pretending to sleep. And it was that time in your life where you're like thinking of mortality and like, I hope that I die before my parents, where you're really afraid of dying. So I was having trouble sleeping in those days. And I was just kind of wide awake thinking about death, and they thought I was asleep. And so I start hearing the bed creaking, right? And I'll never forget, this. And so my, and so Roy said, you know, could you do something besides just laying there like a dead fish? And I, you know, like, I didn't even know what to picture, you know, other than a dead fish. I mean, you know, but like, I didn't know at that point even what all was entailed, what, you know, I didn't even, I don't even think I'd ever heard of the missionary position, but I just knew that being a dead fish while having sex was not a good thing. It was not a good look, and I didn't ever want to be a dead fish. So I became very interested in being a being a skilled, a skilled partner in bed. So that became somewhat of a, you know, something I always want to work on.
A goal.
A goal, yes. And yeah, I did okay.
That's so funny. Okay, is there any, you said you were 35 when your mom died? 30?
Yeah, 35.
Was there like, I don't know, were there any sort of like things that you wish that you had said to her, or like issues that you wish you had been able to resolve before she died?
I was just reading her diaries recently from those years leading up to her death. And so she was diagnosed in like, oh gosh, maybe 80 with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And she went in and out of remission like three or four times. She lasted 17 years.
That's amazing.
And when I decided to go to college back to the living vicariously, she thought I would pick a California school. And I did apply to California schools, and I got into Berkeley and I don't know, some USC, I think. And I was really into politics, her fault. And I decided I wanted to go back east, and I got into, I wanted to go to Georgetown, but I didn't get in. But I went to George Washington University, and I just, you know, it was blocks from the White House, and she couldn't believe that I would, you know, move so far away. And she actually moved to back to Chicago so she could be closer to me. I don't know how that makes sense at all, but she wanted to be closer to me, and she thought, you know, Chicago, I have friends. So she moved back to Chicago for a couple of years. And she came to visit me in Washington my freshman year, and I was individuating, you know, I'm just like have all my friends, and you know, I was like, my mom's coming, but I didn't really want her to. And I think I might have been a little bit embarrassed by her. I think she, at that point, was, you know, wearing a wig, and she had, you know, she was really swollen from the prednisone for a long time. And so I think, you know, I might, I don't know, but I'm thinking I might have just been, you know, like, is this person I the person I want my friends to meet, you know, like that sounds horrible, but I'm, you know, I was 18 years old and I was looking to impress all my new friends. And so anyway, she came in for the weekend. We had a pretty good time, but when she left, I asked her if she would take a cab to the airport. I didn't have a car, but I didn't go with her to the airport in the cab, and she thought I would. And I was like, no, mom, I'll just put you in a cab. And I read in the diary recently that for her, that's when everything changed in our relationship, because she drove off in the cab and she was crying, and I didn't like turn around and wave. And so that was for her like the defining moment of our relationship, going south. And so then, it was tough. She didn't approve of the man I married, my first husband. And she literally said to me, "I always thought you'd marry a doctor or a lawyer, So
If you weren't gonna be one, I would marry one.
right?
That's so funny.
Yeah, the thinking is just so foreign. But so anyway, when so we went through some pretty tough years. I mean, it was like the last 20 years of our relationship were kind of rocky, and I don't think she liked me very much. But then when I moved back to San Diego after college and graduate school, I started taking her to all her doctor's appointments. And then by then I'd had kids, and she was a great, great grandmother. She had just a really special bond with both my children. And so that take going to the doctor's appointments and the chemo sessions and that kind of thing, I mean, that just kind of breaks everything down, and you become really vulnerable with each other. So I think we were able to get back to that place of, where I, she was my mom and I loved her and I didn't want to lose her, and I treasured our time together. Maybe not as much as she would have hoped, at least according to the diaries, but I felt like we had made up some really good ground there the last couple of years. And then when she was in hospice, she had a, she was hospiced in the home, so hospital bed in the living room and all, and I was there. We, all the several of us were just kind of holding vigil, and I spent a lot of time just in her hospice bed with her, just curled up next to her, and just letting her know it was okay. And so I think we got to a really good place in the end. I remember your episode, because you were talking about pain, and here's my mom, 17 years with cancer, and going through all these treatments,
And you kind of forget about it, and then you go, oh
And by this time she was working as a food and beverage manager for a country club, and she worked really long hours, and she didn't believe in wearing sensible shoes, so she was always, just and but she fell and broke her elbow and had neuropathy, and it was really hard when I was reading her diaries to read about how much pain she was in. I don't think I fully appreciated. I mean, she told me she was in pain, but I was having my own issues. I was having, I didn't have a great marriage. I'd had a child with birth defects. I'd had a baby right after that, so I was kind of busy and kind of maybe stuck in my own little.
You might not live to see me realize my dream. It's cold out here. It's so
So, when my mom and I were really, really close. I was, as a, despite her flaws, because she's human, we went watch sunsets. We lived near the beach, and we would go, watch sunsets most nights, and we traveled together. We traveled really well together. We would drive every summer back and forth from Iowa and had just these great adventures. But something was happening in my life that was really difficult, and or had happened in my life that I'd never told her about. And that was that my brother Steve had molested me for several years as a child, sexually molested me. And so when I was about 16, he was over. He had moved out by then, but he was over for dinner one night, and he was still verbally abusing me. So he would wait. He was kind of, he'd just wait and like, in the bushes until the, you know, some, my mom would leave the room and then he would say something really cruel to me. Mm-hmm. And so he used to call me Amy Big Butt. And so, yeah, I know. We're like, could you get a little more creative? Good Lord. But it hurt at the time. You know, yeah. I didn't laugh at it then. But he said something about my breaking a chair when I sat down on a chair. And I lost it. It was just, who knows, you know, why that triggered
the dam break.
Yeah, but yeah. It did. And so I went upstairs and I was just crying and hysterical, literally hysterical. Mm-hmm. And my mom came up and she hadn't heard it. So she didn't, had no idea what was going on. And my brother's like, I don't know, you know, like she just started crying, you know? Mm-hmm. So she comes up and then she, you know, and I'm going, you know, I'm a young woman now and I'm going through my own sort of sexual discovery. And so, right. And I'm, you know, I've got all this baggage that I'm right. carrying around, you know, mm-hmm. and I'm terrified of sex, actually, you know, and like, all I can see is dead fishes, but no, yeah. fish is dead. All I can see is dead fish. But anyway, she comes up and she's, and I'm like, you know, heaving and sighing and I can't get the words out. I was like, what's the matter? What's the matter? And I said, you know, Steve molested me. You know, he forced me to give him blowjobs is what I told her. And,
yeah.
And she had this look on her face that told me she knew. And it wasn't a surprise. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if he'd done some other really weird stuff that she yeah. knew about, or she knew this specifically, but she wasn't surprised. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, she comforted me, by the time I calmed down, she said, you know, I just want this to be our little secret. Like, let's just keep this between ourselves. And I did.
Yeah,
I did until I was 47. That was the next time I told anybody about it.
Wow.
And so for me, I didn't know why I was so angry at my mom until much, much later, like after she died is when I realized,
yeah.
Oh, I was really pissed at her for 20 years because she did this thing to me where she made me, you know, yeah. hold on to this secret
yeah.
and not speak my truth. Mm-hmm. And so not that I had an excuse for saying mean things to her in my 20s, because I didn't, and she was a great mom. But I think, you know, just to give it some context.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell Me About Your Mother is part of the Critical Frequency Network. It's produced by me, Amy Westervelt, and our music is by B. Beeman. Original illustrations for each episode are drawn by James Guthman.